Libraries are institutions that survive time. They're supposed to be around forever. That's the point. They face crises, of course, budget cuts, leaking roofs, and that sort of thing. They're easily dealt with. More challenging is the retirement of great librarians, like Marie-Louise Ayres, Director General of the National Library of Australia, who, after a great run of nearly 25 years, is about to disappear. We thought that before she does, in April, we should drag her on to Late Night Live for a searching exit interview. Marie-Louise, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thanks very much, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, look, you got into this game, if I remember rightly, as a collector, as an archivist, somebody hoovering up documents to tell us what the past was like. It is a commonplace now for people to say, we'll never be able to do that again because everything is electronic, people don't keep letters anymore, all will be lost. Is that proving true?
No, it's not. I think the arc of collecting has changed over time and it's continuing to change. We are certainly still seeing, David, really huge personal archives come in paper form, but these days they're generally accompanied by a digital archive. So it is not the same. You can't see the colour of the paper or the scrappy bit of notepaper paper that something was written on that might give you a bit of extra evidence about what was going on, but we can and do collect the content and can make that accessible. I think one of the future challenges is how to make mixed collections like that more meaningful to researchers. That's a challenge still ahead of us.
What about when technologies change? I mean, the USB stick made 20 years ago just might not be usable, downloadable in time.
Absolutely. So look, I guess we're specialists in preserving digital materials. And in fact, in this building, we have almost like a museum of ancient audio recording equipment, old computers that we need to keep running because sometimes we need to use them to get content, you know, off those older formats. Almost every format, who remembers mini DATs, tiny little cassette tapes we can deal with. But we do tend these days to engage earlier with creators about their archives. We give them advice early on to say, if you've got this archive, think about doing this sooner rather than later.
Ah.
Please don't put it all on a USB stick. So we're having to not intervene, but engage earlier with writers, thinkers, creators to give them advice about how best to keep their digital archives so that it can be presented to a library at some point in the future. Whereas in the old days, look, we'd go into attics and we'd go into, you know, leaky downstairs basements and the paper would be there and it would be there for hundreds of years and we could pick it up and bring it in. We do have to be more proactive these days.
What's the greatest discovery you've made in your career of collecting documents?
Oh, greatest discovery. Look, it's like having millions and billions of children, David. Sometimes it can be really small things that just spark something in you. It's interesting. The thing my mind is going to straight away is Bligh's List of Mutineers. Now, I'm not a colonialist, and it's not that I think that this is the most important collection item in our collection at all. But it's one of those things where occasionally you do handle a physical collection item and it has power. You can feel it. You can feel the malice coming through the centuries.
What is it, this document?
Oh, well, Bligh wrote this list. It's on a very scrappy piece of paper. It's folded over. It's very delicate. And it was really him writing the names and all the characteristics that would identify the mutineers. And
the people who threw him off the bounty.
Absolutely. And he is determined that they are going to be hunted down to the ends of the earth. So he describes their tattoos or any of their defining characteristics. And for me, this thing feels, I can feel his determination and his malice over time. So I think I'd say rather than a single discovery, It is the incontrovertible fact that collection material, and especially in physical form, has deep embodied qualities that researchers and those who come to see materials in the library can actually feel. This is, you know, researchers have written about this, I have felt it. So I suppose it's that realisation that you are simply not talking about words, you're talking about something that's coming through time and sometimes very strong emotions coming through over time as well.
I remember a phone call from you. A phone call to me to say that the papers of Patrick White had survived. And I had thought that his devoted literary executor would have fulfilled the duties set out for her in Patrick White's will to destroy everything that remained in his desk, in the drawers, in the house. And you rang me one day in about sometime in the early 2000s. And what was the news you had for me, Marie-Louise?
Well, that actually not only had the Patrick White archive survived, but it was in this library and I could see it while I was speaking to you. And I do remember this as being the most fun phone call I've ever made in my career, David, because listeners, there was silence on the other end of the phone for what felt like a very long time. And then David said, "The old bugger."
That's right, I did.
And I mean, I knew that it was fun for me, but thinking about what it was like for you on the other end of that phone call, where you had devoted so much of your life and to also being a real partner with the National Library in making sure that whatever Patrick material there was out there in the wild was brought in into safe custody so it could be used. For you to have that moment of realising you'd been doing that for a very, very long time and all of this content in the archive was not available to you, you must have had very mixed feelings, whereas for me the feelings were of joy, of realising that this was a really solemn responsibility. I'd had, before I called you, David, I'd had the opportunity when the material came in from Barbara, I spent a weekend here alone at the library and I unpacked every box, you know, going through item by item, the day diaries where towards the end of his life, every few days he would write
Pred,
which of course was prednisolone as his asthma got worse. And then I got to the last box and I opened two crumpled yellow envelopes and in one of them was Patrick's beret and in the other was his glasses, yes, still with finger marks on them, and I lost it. I just cried. I wept for what this meant for Australia, what this meant for scholarship, what it meant that Barbara, his executor, had obviously struggled for a long time about was she going to honour what Patrick had told her to do. She justified this to herself, and I think this is right. Of course, we no longer have Barbara to talk about this with it. She also noted that Manoli always knew where it was and didn't say anything about it and didn't ask her to destroy it, and that she took that into account in making her decision. And I'm so glad that she did.
Well, that was the things we found there. But you asked me, do you think you'd have time to come down and help us sort these papers? I think I was there about 5.5 minutes later, wasn't I? Something like that. Anyway,
yes,
now look.
Something like that.
This is not about me. Marie-Louise, as a librarian, you also have the task from time to time of withholding material from people.
Yes, we do.
And in particular, recently, there has been a movement to allow Indigenous communities to decide what Indigenous materials that libraries hold, perhaps have held for decades, what of that can be read by a scholar who comes down to read. Mm. How have your feelings on this changed over time?
Yes. David, I think because so much of my early career was spent around archives where you're always thinking about about copyright, and you're also thinking about access rights. So if somebody deposits an archive with the library, they can get to decide, is this whole collection available for research for a certain period of time? What can people do with it? And over the years, I had some extraordinary conversations with people who were transferring papers to us, quite often at the ends of their lives, actually, where they were struggling with ethical issues. And the ethical issue they struggled with was, look, I have all of these letters from this person where they might be talking about their life and work that are in my archive. How do I feel about handing that over to a library? So I think I'd say I had that basis, that sense that it's never over open slather with collections, that there are a set of kind of conditions that need to be met. I would say, though, that 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago, when we first really started thinking seriously about the what I regard as an incontrovertible reality, that is Indigenous cultural and intellectual property rights, this really changed my thinking about a lot of the collections that I knew and ones that I had brought in, where I realised that we were by provenance in libraries. We tend to think a lot about the person who has given us the collection. But when I started to reverse my thinking or expand my thinking to say, well, you know, actually, often what's in a library is the paper records that were created by others that is carrying the knowledge and the culture of others. I felt as if my whole understanding of collections almost exploded, David. It was a really significant time for me, and along with many of my colleagues in the entire cultural sector, we have been grappling with this since. You know, given that we've only started thinking in this way and working in this way within the last decade, we have a long way to run on this. Where it's easier for us is when we're bringing in new collections. We go to a lot of trouble now to make sure that family and community are really happy for, you know, that collection, that item, that painting, that archive is going to be here at the library. Everybody needs to be happy with it. Where it is more difficult is those collections that have been with us for decades and, as you say, have been used by historians, linguists, anthropologists who've been working in good faith for a very long time and are having to come to terms with a different relationship with the material itself, with the knowledge it embodies, and coming to terms with the fact that we're talking about community knowledge, which is different to our sense of Western sense of individual ownership. We're partway through this process at the moment. It is not easy. It's forming a very large part of our work. And I really understand that for researchers who've been working, as I say, in good faith for a very long time, this is can be quite difficult for them to come to terms with.
It's a huge...
Most do. They find that if they do engage with communities, actually their knowledge is expanded. So it is a big change. And I don't think any of us can pretend that it's something that you just switch on and off. In my view, it'll take probably some decades for this to fully work itself out in the way that we understand knowledge in this country.
It's a subject we're going to take up down the track on Late Night Live because it fascinates us. But look, what I want to do now is to thank you for one or two things. Trove. This is the most amazing engine for revealing the past to us. A free digital search engine that can search by word and name and place the tiniest details of Australian history. Now, how much of this is your achievement, madam?
Oh, David, it's the achievement of many people. It goes back to, people think the Trove came out of nowhere, and it didn't. Right back in 1981, this library, the National Library of Australia, started working with other libraries in Australia to create what was really the first National Union Catalogue that was in electronic form. So there's a lot of antecedents to Trove. Before Trove, there was this thing we called the National Bibliographic Database. There was Picture Australia. There was Music Australia. Yes, they were National Library innovations. Nobody had done anything like that before. Then we started digitising newspapers, of course, in 2007. And then the real work was very much joint work in this library. I was privileged to be part of it, but some of the library's greatest thinkers were really behind how are we going to bring this all together into one comprehensible package. So, yes, I was a part of it, and I eventually became the boss of Trove or the queen of Trove.
Well, I like that title. I think it suits.
Yeah, but look, nothing happens here individually. It's large teams. It's teams of 20 and 30 people. One of the great thinkers here was Warwick Castro, my friend and former colleague. And even Warwick says, no, it wasn't me. It was these two marvellous people, Kent Fitch, still a good friend of mine, the late Judith Pearce, one of the greatest thinkers the library has ever had, who just put these brilliant minds together in an environment where the library could make decisions that it was going to do this. So it's never an individual achievement at all. I enjoyed my time as Queen of Trove, but I was not its mother. I was one of many people involved.
Never the mother of Trove. It's very kind of you to put it in that way. But is there anything like Trove? Is there anything like it in the world?
No, there isn't. I think, clearly its distinctive thing for us as Australians is exactly that. It's Australianness. And I think that's really important. Other countries have parts of this. And, of course, there is Europeana in Europe, which brings together quite a large number of collections. But it doesn't have that distinctive flavour, and it doesn't have all of the things that we have been able to build into Trove. The searchability, being able to text search not just the newspaper archives, but we were the first country in the world to make Australian web archive, which we've been collecting since 1996, fully available online and text searchable. That was absolutely, a world leader. And, of course, more recently, we're the only place in the world that's instituted what we call handwritten text recognition, which does for print. What OCR does for print, it does it for handwritten manuscripts. So I think it's really original.
Are you developing a program that will allow us to read 19th century handwriting? That would be an advance in scholarship of the most remarkable kind.
Well, David, I've always said I was not going to retire until this was done. And it's done.
Oh, fabulous. So,
now, I have to say, we did not develop the technology. What we figured out is how to put it into a big production system and apply it across a very big quantity of data. So we've now applied handwritten text recognition in Trove to around 1.3 million pages of 19th and early 20th century manuscript. We've got about 8.5 million pages to go, and we will probably get that done in the next couple of years. So I always knew early in my career, I knew that one day there would be a way to make it so much easier to actually delve into the guts of archives without having to be on site, although I think you can't replace that experience, and where new meanings would be drawn out of archives simply because you can search in completely different ways to what you, David, have done sitting in a reading room or opening box after box, folder after folder. So I think this is really exciting.
Learning to read people's handwriting.
It's
horrible.
It's pretty good at it. Libraries around the world contributed examples of their most difficult text to a project, it must be 10 or 15 years ago, that was funded by the European Union. You can't get funding like that in Australia, to really deal with very difficult handwriting. There have been jokes, David, about whether it would manage my handwriting. Some rude staff members have suggested this might not be the case, but it's actually really pretty good, including for tiny handwriting, for German Gothic. It's pretty good.
What about those documents where there's the ordinary lines like that and then they go back up again on the diagonal? Can they read like those vile
marvellous
documents?
Marvellous Jane Austen cross-hatching. It can manage that. So it's really, I do think that this just opens up a completely different world.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr and I am talking to Marie-Louise Ayres, the departing Chief Librarian. Now, that's not your title. Director General of the National...
Director General, pretty good one, isn't it?
It sounds quite warlike, which is not, in my experience, altogether out of place. Now, Marie-Louise, what are you digitising of the collection? Now, you talked before about Bligh's list of mutineers. Is that now in electronic form? Can I sit at home and read it?
You certainly can. David, we've digitised, we estimate, 10% of our collection, and it may never go above that because the collection grows every year still by about 2 linear kilometres every year. Even though we are now collecting digital, that's how much it grows by.
Hey, tell us how many kilometres of shelving have you got at the moment?
Oh, nearly 300.
300 kilometres.
Yes, so roughly if you were driving down here to Canberra and you had all of our shelves laid out end to end, you wouldn't reach the end of it before you got to the library. So it's a very large collection. But in terms of what we're digitising, David, it's interesting that when digitisation started in libraries like this, initially we all thought that we needed to do the most iconic, the most rare, the most unique things.
Yes.
So things like Bligh's list of mutineers, Cook's journal, those things are actually digitised quite early. Then, of course, when we got onto digitising newspapers, it became really apparent to us that what was of most use to the Australian public was actually the everyday. You know, you might love to see that list of mutineers or Cook's journal online, and that is wonderful, but it's not what opens up Australian history for most people. So moving into the kind of everyday was important. That has driven our thinking since. We're closing in on having digitised all pre-1956 newspapers. That's a copyright date. We've digitised very large amounts of ephemera, including all of our federal election ephemera. We're digitising more books. We've digitised lots of journals, things like the Women's Weekly, the Bulletin, down to the smallest journals that somebody has an interest in. So more texture there.
So much of what you've been doing in the last 25 years, digitising, you know, allowing us access from our own desks at home, is sort of emptying the building. You're working to empty the building.
No, we'll never empty the building. David, and I'm very very happy that our current minister, Tony Burke, I think one of the first things that he really expressed and got about the library is that our collection will continue to grow. So we're not emptying the building. We're not emptying the building of collections. We do not throw things away when we digitise them. It's just another mode of access. I can tell you the building is not empty today. There are people streaming in.
Good.
To use our collections, to use our Wi-Fi, to go to a place where they know they write better than elsewhere. So we're not emptying the building. It is used for many different purposes.
Good.
And I don't see any sign at all that it won't remain the incredibly vibrant place it is now.
Marie-Louise, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
My pleasure, David. And I just wanted to say, just to conclude, that libraries do go on. Leaders come and go. There is so much wonderful talent in this organisation that will take the library forward into the future as I sail off into the sunset.
Marie-Louise, can I also give thanks to a generation of people who have dug through the wonderful stuff in the National Library? It's been thrilling. It's been really thrilling. Thank you.
Just as thrilling for me, David.
Have they digitised you?
Have they digitised me? Well, there's plenty of photographs, and I have to say the ones from when I started here, strangely enough, I look a lot younger.
Strangest thing. I mean, electronic reproduction can do that.
Yes.
Thank you so much. I have been talking to Marie-Louise Ayres, the retiring Director General of the National Library of Australia. on Late Night Live.